News Weekly is an ad-free listener-supported podcast made possible by listeners like you. Just go to patreon.com/samishah, that's S-A-M-I-S-H-A-H, to support the podcast. Top stories of the week. Snorting cocaine off the checkbook journalism. Also, Australia elects new queen. Plus, who aids the aid workers? All that and more on News Weekly. Hello and welcome to News Weekly, where we punch the news in the headlines weekly. When one person says it's raining and another says it isn't, a journalist's job is to buy them both bags of cocaine and prostitutes to get an exclusive. News now. In journalism courses at most universities, it's important to teach future journalists about the ethics of modern journalism. These include such basic rules as the importance of objectivity or the need to double-check information even if it's coming from a reliable source, and of course, to never pay for an interview. And if you do a good enough job imparting these values, then the next generation of journalists will graduate with degrees in journalism and enrich mainstream news gathering with their commitment to ethical journalism. Or they can join Channel 7 and pay a former young Liberal staffer accused of sexual assault to snort cocaine and get hand jobs at a massage parlour, which is basically what counts as mainstream journalism in Australia now.
Good evening. First up tonight, claims of drugs during dinner.
Mr. Auerbach says the cocaine incident happened after a boozy dinner in Sydney, while he says he was, quote, babysitting Mr. Lehrman.
Taylor Auerbach alleged he was Mr. Lehrman's babysitter, ordered to get an interview with him at all costs by his seven bosses.
The affidavit alleges Seven reimbursed Bruce Lehrman for illicit drugs and prostitutes over two nights in January last year.
As Ten's new witness made claims about the former political staffer buying drugs over dinner.
It also details payments for Thai massages worth more than $10,000.
A round of golf in Tasmania, pricey meals around Sydney and massages amounting to more than $10,000. The pair went back to Lehrman's Meriton suite. He's told the court Lehrman then started talking to me about a prospective spotlight story and his desire to order prostitutes when the company corporate card was billed thousands for Thai massages.
Though Mr. Auerbach concedes he no longer has a copy of the invoice.
You always keep the receipts. You know HR will ask for them. All this information has come to light, by the way, only because Bruce Lehrman sued Channel 10 for its interview with Brittany Higgins. In legal terms, launching a defamation lawsuit, which then backfires on you while you're being paid by Channel 7, is technically called pulling a Ben Robert Smith, I believe. But I'm not trying to bog you down with too much legalese here. The details of Lehrman's weekend of cocaine, prostitutes, Thai massages and expensive restaurants was revealed when a former Channel 7 producer was invited to the stand to give evidence against Bruce Lehrman. By the way, the last time I did a documentary for ABC, the public broadcaster, they gave me a taxi voucher for the cost of travel but asked me to take a train at least halfway to my destination or the producer might get in trouble if the ABC got billed too much for my cab. In case you're ever wondering what the difference is between commercial versus taxpayer-funded news resources. What happened to the producer when Channel 7 found out about the expenses they'd just been billed for, which it should be remembered was on top of the over $100,000 in rent Channel 7 also paid for Bruce Lehrman to stay in a luxury apartment for 1 year? I mean, after all, this is the same channel that in 2018 tried to drop its employee agreement covering penalty rates, rosters and redundancy provisions back to minimum conditions due to budget cuts. I mean, they must have been furious with the producer to let this happen.
He was offered a pay rise and promotion after billing a night out with Lehrman to a corporate credit card.
All right, so maybe the standards for career advancement are a bit different at Channel 7. So, what did they get for all this money?
Such as Brittany Higgins' private text messages and AFP's statement of facts. And Auerbach claims Lehrman himself was seen photocopying material at Seven's office. Under oath in court, Lehrman has previously denied ever handing over documents from the criminal trial.
All of which resulted in 500,000 people tuning into Channel 7 last June when the episode of Spotlight with Bruce Lehrman aired. So it turns out audiences do tune in to watch a show involving sex and drugs, even if all the sex and drugs happened off camera. Spotlight's producer, meanwhile, has previously rejected any claims of wrongdoing, claiming...
7 News Spotlight made no payment to Bruce Lerman for the interview. However, the program assisted with accommodation as part of the filming of the story.
Which is true. They did assist with the accommodation by paying $4,000 a fortnight for 1 year plus food and entertainment. That's all. And if you want more details than that, you're going to have to get the producer a bag of coke, a prostitute and a Thai massage handy first. That, after all, is just basic journalism. Governor General of Wokeism news now. One of the more embarrassing facts about Australia is that it is still a colony of the British, not managing to throw off the yoke of a faded empire that still clings to titles like the Marchioness of Cholmondeley. I mean, my grandparents kicked the Brits out and India had much more to offer the crown, like the literal crown itself, or at least some of the more prominent jewels in it, plus all the curries and spices and billions of pounds of wealth and loot. So you'd think it wouldn't be hard for Australians to realise it's embarrassing to still have to pay fealty to inbred Germans sitting in England and cut them loose. But instead, we continue our servitude by every few years appointing a new Governor General, the representative of the Crown in Australia. The role itself is ceremonial in practice, with the Governor General only approving what the Parliament or the Prime Minister tells them to approve. Although in theory, they do have wide-ranging powers to dismiss governments, like in 1975, when then-Governor-General Sir John Kerr dismissed the Whitlam government, either to end a constitutional crisis or because the CIA told him to, depending on who you believe. My money's on the CIA, and if you don't believe me, listen to The 11th, an excellent documentary podcast by the ABC, which basically makes the same argument. Anyway, back to the Governor-General. Australia's last one was General David Hurley, whose legacy of 4 years as colonial ruler of Australia was to approve the secret appointment of Scott Morrison to multiple ministries without ever asking why, and being married to Linda Hurley, who used her husband's high-profile job to launch her musical career.
Walking on our pathways or riding on our bikes, exercise is helping to make us feel more bright.
There's a special group, Invasion Species Solutions Trust, a philanthropic opportunity to help native animals, a must.
This couple called the Shepherds wanted children to listen and speak. They searched and went to Los Angeles, where a clinic had methods they tweaked.
You know what? Good on her. If her husband's got a made-up job, then why not have a made-up musical career if you want one? Now, while there's no official limit on how long a Governor-General serves, they tend to retire after about 4 or 5 years, or in David Hurley's case, a year or so after the Albanese government cancelled the $18 million in funding he'd been receiving for a charity that didn't have an office, website or staff. Which means it's time for Prime Minister Anthony Albanese to appoint a new Governor-General. And if Albanese is going to do anything, he's first going to see if Kevin Rudd did it as well, then somehow do a worse version. In 2008, Rudd appointed Australia's first female Governor-General, Dame Quinton Brice. And so now, in 2024, Albo's not letting Rudd out-equality him.
Ms. Mostyn will be the 28th Governor-General of the Commonwealth of Australia and the second woman to hold this highest of office.
Samantha Mostyn is the next Governor-General. So, who is she?
Sam Mostyn is a businesswoman, a lawyer and former AFL commissioner, now soon to be Australia's 28th Governor-General, a role she says she's ready to serve with integrity, compassion and respect. Ms. Mostyn grew up in an army family. Her dad served in Vietnam. She then went on to become a lawyer as well as a high-regarded business leader and has worked with Reconciliation Australia, Beyond Blue and the Australia Council of the Arts and, for over a decade, the AFL, where she was a strong advocate for the creation of the AFL Women's Competition. Now, in 2021, Ms. Mostyn was awarded an Officer of the Order of Australia. Currently, she's President at Chief Executive Women.
All right, sounds pretty qualified to me. Andrew Bolt, what do you think?
Now, one thing is absolutely clear. Sam Mostyn sure has made affirmative action work for her. Demanding that women get jobs ahead of men looks like it's helped her to become our next Governor General. Here's proof that affirmative action really does help. Well, mostly a highly political class of women, particularly Mostyn.
Yep, about what we thought you'd think. It's affirmative action, unlike the 26 men who held the post before, who were all there purely on merit, of course. For Sky News After Shot panellists, Sam Mostyn represents everything they hate. She's a woman, and she's progressive, and I think that's it, actually. But it's bad enough that they've had to invoke the word woke to describe her, which conservatives only use to attack anyone and everyone they're angry at that day.
No, it's a terrible choice. She's the queen of woke. But this is the Prime Minister's choice. This is the Prime Minister's captain's pick. And quite frankly, Albanese has given a middle finger salute to every single Australian who voted no to his voice. 60% of people he's given the middle finger salute to by appointing the most woke person.
By the way, she isn't Indigenous, so I'm not sure what this has to do with voice to Parliament, but apparently she is the queen of woke, which is still less stupid than being the king of England. So, just what has she done that's so woke? Why is she a middle finger to 60% of Australians who frankly could do with a middle finger now and then? Well, here's Fido Fondler, Chris Kenny.
Primarily, she's pushed quite a radical feminist agenda in business, but she's also been at the forefront on climate activism, and she's led the charge for the ESG agenda, that push for business to focus less on the bottom line and more on the environment, social and governance goals set by the United Nations.
Just a reminder, Chris Kenny is listing those as criticisms of her, not achievements, in case you were confused. For the rest of us 40% of Australians who aren't feeling middle-fingered by the appointment, there's only one question that matters about Sam Mostyn. Does her husband sing, and will he make visiting Indian cricket teams sing along as well?
My sunshine, my only sunshine, you make me happy when stars are grey.
Come on.
You are the dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away.
Smog of war news now. It's been a few minutes since critics of Israel's ongoing bombardment of Gaza had a chance to say, hey, we really did warn you that this was a terrible idea and it would backfire and lead to horrendous loss of civilian life and make Israel a pariah state because the IDF has a tendency to treat both Palestinian children and international aid organizations as target practice, but you were so caught up in revenge fantasies that you ignored all the lessons learned by America in the post 9/11 years and are continuing to indulge your worst justifications of the increasingly meaningless phrase collateral damage. And even now, it isn't too late to realize a ceasefire doesn't mean Hamas wins, just that this isn't the way Hamas will lose, and in fact, may help it win, and while it may just be too late to stop several decades more of the cycle of violence to continue careening down the bike path of peaceful solutions, it may be worth it to consider that people advising you to stop are actually looking out for your best interests, and your current approach may be why you're in this problem to begin with, as hard as it is to hear that sometimes, but maybe if you can give us an actual number as to how many more children have to starve, families have to be buried under rubble, and aid workers and journalists have to be murdered before you feel like you can take a pause and collect your thoughts, we can try bargaining it downwards. Well, if that's what you miss saying, then Israel just gave you one more chance to say it.
The international condemnation of an Israeli airstrike that killed seven aid workers, including Australian Zomi Frankham in Gaza, is intensifying this morning. As the bodies of the victims are taken to Egypt for repatriation, the founder of the group they worked for has accused Israeli forces in Gaza of systematically targeting the cars of aid workers.
Now, the reason that Jose Andreas, who founded World Central Kitchen, is accusing Israel of targeting the vehicles carrying the aid workers is because World Central Kitchen communicated the path it would take, had clear signs on the roof of its vehicles, had permission from the IDF to go down that path, and even signaled to the IDF that it was on the journey. Then a drone blew up the first car, then the second car, then the third car, killing seven aid workers. The IDF calls that a mistake, and everyone else not out of their fucking minds calls that a whole lot of things that aren't a mistake. The problem for Israel is that this isn't the first time it's blown up aid workers in safe zones, as Channel 4 in the UK details here.
But it's not the first time that humanitarians have come under fire in a conflict that has already cost the lives of at least 196 aid workers.
In November, this convoy of vehicles belonging to Médecins Sans Frontières was attacked by a tank during an attempt to evacuate south from Gaza City. The charity says not only were they travelling in clearly marked vehicles and had notified the IDF, but that they were following a route indicated to them by Israeli forces. On January 18th, the accommodation and offices used by the British charity Medical Aid for Palestinians was hit by an airstrike in the supposedly safe zone of Al-Mawasi. They had sent their coordinates to the IDF, who at first denied responsibility, then said the strike was a mistake. on January 29th in the neighbourhood of Tel al-Hawa in Gaza City. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society sent an ambulance to rescue 6-year-old Hind Rajab, who was trapped in a car with her family after they were killed by Israeli forces. The ambulance crew radioed to say they were being targeted by IDF lasers. There was a loud explosion and the connection was lost. 10 days later, after the charred vehicles were discovered, the IDF said they were looking into it.
That report goes on for a while, but you get the idea. Meanwhile, Israeli newspaper Haaretz has quoted Israeli army sources as saying the Gaza aid workers were killed because, quote, IDF officers on the ground do what they want, end quote. And here's the thing, saying this is bad isn't holding Israel to an unrealistic standard that isn't applied to anyone else. 8 years ago, the United States bombed an MSF hospital in Afghanistan by mistake as well.
At least 19 people were killed today at a hospital in Afghanistan. It was bombed in what appears to have been an American airstrike aimed at Taliban militants. Dozens more were wounded at the hospital, which is run by the aid organization Doctors Without Borders.
Daybreak in Kunduz revealed the results of an hour-long bombardment. The hospital run by Doctors Without Borders still burning. Inside, bloodied staff slumped in hallways. Surgery still underway in a makeshift operating room.
They saw patients burning in their beds. I mean, completely traumatic, distressing scenes.
The aid group said from 2:08 a.m. until 3:15 local time, its hospital was rocked by aerial assaults every 15 minutes.
At the time, the U.S. first said the Taliban did it. Then it said it was Afghan military and finally admitted it was America that did it all along. And at the time, there was international condemnation and calls for independent investigation. And here's the thing, I can guarantee you almost no one listening to this podcast remembers this happened. If you don't believe me, Google the Kunduz, K-U-N-D-U-Z, hospital airstrike. And that's just one example. There have been many more. And each time there was condemnation and there were called for independent investigation. So asking Israel to not kill civilians again and again isn't holding Israel to an unrealistic standard. It's just holding it to the standard we hope everyone is held to. And you can tell things have gotten serious because now the Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and Foreign Minister Penny Wong are speaking to Israel with a slightly sterner tone of voice.
Australia has called for a humanitarian ceasefire. We have voted that way at the United Nations. I've issued multiple statements with the Prime Minister of Canada and New Zealand, as well as with ASEAN leaders. From the very beginning, we have said that every innocent life matters.
And I have said publicly, as has the Prime Minister, we want an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. We have said directly to the Netanyahu government that their actions are meaning that they are losing support amongst many countries. And I would say again what I've said to them directly, that the Netanyahu government must change course.
All of which sounds very serious indeed, in that it sounds very, very mild. Meanwhile, Australia is still going ahead with a $900 million contract to an Israeli drone manufacturing company, which built the drone that killed the Australian civilian working with World Central Kitchen. So maybe the Australian government could put their money where their mouth is, the way they took their money away from Palestinian mouths when it briefly defunded UNRWA a few months back. And just a reminder that the 7 World Central Kitchen deaths are now added to the overall 33,000 killed in Gaza and 1,139 killed in Israel, with dozens more still held hostage since October 7th, all of which means this fog of war is just going to keep getting thicker unless something changes soon. That's it for this week's edition of News Weekly. As always, you can support the podcast by heading over to iTunes, giving it a 5-star rating and a good review. That really helps the podcast. Or head over to Patreon, join my patreon.com/Sammy Shah and find book reviews and comedy festival recommendations, etc. all over there. Otherwise, just stick around. I'll be back here next week with another episode of News Weekly, where we punch the news in the headlines weekly.